Support for Sound Effect comes from WSECU. Local to Washington, WSECU is a credit union founded in public service. Today, WSECU serves more than 260,000 members. More information is available at wsecu.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
My name is Jack McQuaid. I'm co-owner of the Swiss Restaurant and Pub with my wife, Carol Ann, and we're sitting at the bar right in front of the 31 taps we have, and we also have Chihuly glass on top of this great old bar from 1913.
Hey, I'm Gabriel Spitzer. You're listening to Sound Effect. And when Jack McQuaid says he has artwork by legendary glass artist Dale Chihuly sitting on top of his bar in Tacoma, he's not kidding.
This is from Dale's Venetian series. Dale and his crew were putting in the glass down at the Union Station, and they were coming up for lunches and dinners and got to know the crew. And we were hoping maybe to get a small painting. And then one night, Dale came in, and it was his idea to put the glass on top of the bar, and he'd come in with his lighting crew and the pieces, and they installed them. And we have 8, and we love them.
8 shimmering pieces from probably the most famous glass artist in the world. Jack says they're worth a few bucks.
We've been here for 26 years, and we've had the glass work for about 25. Back in those days, it was about $250,000. Now we're here in like $350. But when I tell the story, $250,000 just kind of rolls off the tongue a little better.
Now, with absolutely no disrespect to the Swiss Restaurant and Pub, this might not be the place you'd expect to see a pricey art collection. This is more of a good burger and a pint kind of a place, a pub where you see a local band or play some bar trivia. But Jack says that this collection of 3-foot-tall, lushly colored wild glass vases has become part of this place. They survived the Nisqually earthquake in this bar. And Jack says nobody has ever tried to vandalize them. So while the Swiss might not be a museum, he doesn't find this collection out of place.
I mean, I think everybody gets a kick out of seeing them. I mean, a lot of this stuff is in museums around the world. You know, this is a nice experience for people to be especially surprised when they walk in and get a little culture and a little art while they're having a pint.
And yes, it was a little nerve-wracking caring for these high-priced art pieces at first, but you get used to it.
They gave me a box of cloth baby diapers and some cleaners, and I've got a big ladder, and I clean them every 2 months. Yeah, once you get past the first time doing it, you're not as nervous.
Collections come in all shapes and sizes. I tried collecting kaleidoscopes for a minute. My son used to collect bottle caps. Toby got tired of his room smelling like Budweiser. I once met a guy who ardently collected used shopping bags. Whatever it is, a collection can take on a life of its own, and it says something about the person behind it. So that's our theme today, the collector, why we're drawn to collect stuff, and what we're willing to do in pursuit of it. Usually when you have a collection, it's stuff you want to be around, like art or classic cars or potholders. Hi, Mom. But what fascinates this next collector are tokens of death. She lives in a part of Mason County surrounded by forests where lots of animals live and, of course, die. To her, what they leave behind isn't gross or creepy. It's beautiful. Sound Effect contributor Max Wasserman has the story.
The first time Amanda Jo turned onto this dirt road, she was just looking for a spot to take photos. She didn't get far before she found something else.
I had to stop real soon because I realized I was running over bones. And they're just everywhere.
To give you an idea of the setting, we're looking at a huge patch of timberland. It's a hot, humid day, and the tree saplings are about neck high. Amanda brushes them aside on a tour of what looks like a dumping ground for hunters. She's thin, but muscular. 2 bird skulls dangle from her ears, kind of like the ones tattooed below her collarbone.
Elk rib, deer rib, deer rib. Pelvis, there's more ribs and vertebra. It's another deer pelvis. There's its fur.
If you're anything like me, you're probably wondering why Amanda comes out here. Well, she collects and cleans animal bones, then turns them into jewelry. Where others see death, she sees beauty.
It wasn't so jarring to see the bones out here, like even though there was just bones scattered everywhere. They were in the grass, and there were vultures, and there were bugs, and everything seemed to be doing the cycle of life that it's supposed to be.
Amanda moved here after years of living in cities across the Puget Sound. Why? Too many rules, she says. Not enough independence. You get a better sense of what that means once you see her property. There's a small house, a goat pen, and several vegetable gardens. And then there's this thing.
So this is my creepy bone shed.
In case you didn't catch that, Amanda is talking about her bone shed. It looks like a chicken coop, except replace all the chickens with animal skeletons and bone buckets.
This is when I first bring it back. This is pretty much where everything goes. Because a lot of it's straight up rotten. I mean, there's still flesh, there's still bugs, there's still beetles bored in there. So it all sits out here until it's kind of finished.
At one point, Amanda puts a giant rib bone next to her chest, like she's trying it on for size.
Would you be able to make something out of that?
Yeah. I actually found a cow skull out on a logging road, which is a really weird thing to come across because they're huge. And I found enough ribs that I think I can make a nice little cow. Kind of like a scarecrow. We kind of need to keep the birds away from the yard.
And nothing says get out like a dead animal carcass.
Scary cow skeleton kind of up in the air. I feel like that'll weird out a bird or two.
To understand how Amanda got into making stuff out of animal bones, we have to go back to a point when she was in grade school. At the time, she was living with her parents near downtown Puyallup. This was the 80s when the area was still full of small farms. On their property was a big red barn.
It was the first time in years that I'd lived someplace that wasn't just, you know, we didn't just live in like a little ticky-tacky house like next to someone else's ticky-tacky house. Like we had a little more space and we had this beautiful area to have these beautiful little baby birds. The nest was like very much at the top of the barn, like right at the peak. So they had to have fallen 20, 25 feet. They looked like they were sleeping. They were just laying in the gravel. But they, I mean, pink. They still didn't quite have all their feathers and stuff. Just the stillness of it, I think, is what was scary for me as a kid. Like, silence and stillness, and something's just gone now.
Her mom suggested they bury the birds, which they did. But before that, Amanda says she just sat there for hours, singing to them.
Sitting with the old dead birds and like singing and crying to them made me feel like I acknowledged them, like I gave them something, and that I still remember them. Like I can still tell the story, I can still see them in the gravel.
This need to appreciate death dovetailed with Amanda's early ambitions as a collector.
Yeah, just anything. Feathers, bits of rusty things, like old broken jewelry. I have like boxes when I was a kid, and they're just full of nonsense. It's like somewhere in my little kid mind, all of those things were treasure and important.
By her early 30s, Amanda's collection was more bones than anything else. She made the jump to a full-time jewelry maker about 7 years ago. As you can imagine, the transition was a slow one.
And in the beginning, I also didn't know skeletons. Like, is it a raccoon? Is it a deer? Is that a people? Like, no, it's never a people. It's never a people. I've looked everywhere. I've never found a people.
Along the way, she learned the ropes. Turns out, anything you're allowed to hunt in Washington is generally fair game for a collection. And cleaning bones? Not that easy. It can take months, especially if there's still meat attached. But what held Amanda back the most wasn't the collecting part. It was something else.
I was worried people would think I was weird more in the beginning. I mean, I made some jewelry for friends who I knew who liked stuff, but I wasn't real vocal to like strangers or other people about what I was doing.
People would sometimes make mean comments at the art fair she'd sell at, or they couldn't understand why someone who didn't eat meat or hunt wanted to wear dead animal parts. They'd ask, "How are you okay with this?" Amanda would respond,
"Because I'm not afraid of death." Like,
the fear Amanda felt seeing those dead birds as a kid, it shrunk bit by bit as she spent more time around bones. The idea of death became less toxic and more normal.
I think the reason wearing bones weirds people out is that you know, you're supposed to look at death a different way. You're supposed to bury the bones. You're supposed to hide them. But we're all made of bones, and we're all going to die. And I think it opens up a conversation for death, which, like, I like talking about death. I deal with death a lot. But it's also the more I talk about it, the less scared I am of it, and hopefully the less scared other people are of it. I would like to eventually, like, be a death doula or do more with, like, humans and death, because I feel like I have an understanding of what the passage is.
When it comes to her own death, Amanda has some ideas. She talks about it as if it's a birthday party, with the same cheer and a touch of practicality.
Washington State's opened up a lot of options for green burial lately, so I think that's amazing. Like, I'd love to be buried under a tree, have a tree grow out of me, or be eaten by a bear, which would be pretty cool. But I think that's a harder one, so I'll go with the being buried under a tree.
Amanda is now in her early 40s. It's not like her death is around the corner, at least not hopefully. But she likes to picture it anyways. Her muscle and skin turning to carbon. Plants and animals feeding off her body. It sounds morbid, and frankly, it gives me the chills. But then there's something reassuring in how it all ends, of just leaving behind a collection of bones.
That story by sound effect contributor Max Wasserman. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is The Collector. Dan Tucker has a thing for trees. It goes back to his upbringing here in the Northwest.
We lived on a really beautiful ranch out in the Coast Range mountains of Oregon, just surrounded by tall, deep, dark green Doug fir forest, and that really imprinted on me.
He gradually began to tell the trees apart, a Douglas fir versus a lodgepole pine versus a western hemlock. But there was this one type of tree that looked really different, like freakishly different.
I remember when I was a kid walking around in Olympia or Seattle or something with my dad, and he pointed one out and said, you know, people call that a monkey puzzle tree because the scales are really sharp and they all point down the branch. And so if a monkey climbed down the branch, then he couldn't climb back up again. And just thinking like, oh, that's funny.
Those scales line these long, tail-like branches and give the tree a decidedly reptilian look. You can spot them here and there in front yards, and soon Dan was keeping an eye out for them. It's an interest that would gradually grow into an obsession, one that Dan would literally bleed for. At the start, though, it was just about the wonder of these unusual trees and the stories they seem to tell.
The reason that they have all those wickedly pointy scales and all that natural armor is that the trees evolved during the Jurassic period, and so they were trying to protect themselves from hungry brachiosaurs and that sort of thing, and so they basically haven't changed much since then, so they're still just kind of waiting for hungry dinosaurs to try to go after them. They just have an ancient, powerful spirit that I feel like spoke to me somehow. A few years after that, I was getting into gardening and permaculture and, you know, was reading a book about all kinds of different food trees. And this book said, and the monkey puzzle tree, Araucaria arcana, it produces, you know, abundant crops of starchy, edible nuts that have been a staple food for thousands of years in Chile. And I remember thinking, whoa, that's really cool. I had no idea, you know, this thing produced food that you could eat. And that kind of took my interest up a whole other level. And then I started looking for them and thinking about them and like, wow, how could I grow one of those? And that's where the journey really started. You know, I just had a feeling like there was more to this tree than what you could see from, you know, one or two growing in someone's yard. And also, you know, I wanted to be able to collect large amounts of the seeds to bring back and plant. And so, yeah, even before my brother ended up going down there to teach English, I had already been kind of scheming on how I would get down to Chile. I set off for Chile. I had a nice, fresh, new sketchbook and, I don't really take pictures, don't really use my phone. You know, I like to sketch instead. So I arrived in Santiago, you know, big, hot, sweaty, grimy city, a lot like Los Angeles, and met up with my brother. And, well, we were traveling by bus, so it was a lot of long, bumpy, dusty bus rides. Finally, we got a bus that was going to take us up over a pass, and right up toward the top of the pass, I looked out and started to see the first couple of monkey puzzle trees, and it was really amazing. You know, here were these just huge, gnarled specimens draped with lichens, kind of looking out over this vast mountain landscape, and I kind of felt like I was going through a gateway into Jurassic Park. You know, and there they were, all these towering old monkey puzzle trees, and, you know, they kind of looked like a herd of dinosaurs or something. And then we came down into this dusty little town. We met a guy who offered to take us and harvest some monkey puzzle seeds. He took out a sack that he tied around his waist, and he had a long, 100-foot-long piece of rope with a metal weight tied on the end, which seemed kind of curious to me. This guy, his name was Manuel, and first big monkey puzzle that we came to, you know, it was a female, and it had some nice big cones. He took out that long piece of rope with the metal weight on the end, and he started spinning it around his head and let fly up into the crown of this tree. And the first throw, it was a direct hit. He hit this seed cone, and it just shattered, and all the seeds came raining down like confetti. It was really awesome. And so, yeah, pretty quickly we had some full bags. And they taste, when you eat them raw, they're kind of crunchy, kind of like a nutty radish or like a carrot. And then when you roast them, they have a really nice kind of like roasted plantain, almost like a mashed potato-like texture, but a sort of a rich, nutty flavor. And they're very good, very starchy. You know, he told me that their livestock eat them and they eat them. And, you know, it's just a big part of their way of life there, and has been for thousands of years. The indigenous people in that part of Chile call themselves Pehuenche, and Pehuen is their name for the monkey puzzle tree. And so they call themselves the people of the monkey puzzle. I didn't really want to leave, but, you know, we had to keep going. And so after that, we got on a bus and went out to Valparaiso, found our way to this hostel. And I woke up early because, you know, I'm a morning person. My brother always sleeps in. So I started wandering around and, you know, had my sketchbook in hand, and I'd had my sketchbook with me the whole trip. I just kept going up and up this hillside because the view got better and better. Could see these two figures way up the staircase above me, and, you know, came up to these two guys and just greeted them, you know, the way you would anyone on the street. And one of them stepped right up close to me. The next thing I knew, the other guy was waving this knife in my face and like, you know, slashing it up and down really violently, like as if he was trying to stab me. And I, you know, I was just completely terrified, had no idea what was going on. And, you know, and then some kind of survival instinct kicked in, and I just turned and started running down the steps. They came after me, and the guy was grabbing my backpack and slashing his knife, and we took a little spill off the bottom of the landing and landed in kind of a heap in the dirt. And I just got up and kept running, and when I got up, they had my backpack. And then I looked down, there was a big stab in my right arm. And I realized, oh crap, they got my sketchbook in the backpack. You know, that's all my memories of the trip and all the pictures that I drew of everything. But then I thought, wait a minute, I've still got the monkey puzzle seeds. They're all in my big backpack in the hostel. And I thought, okay, the mission is not a failure. I made my way back down that steep hillside, clutching my arm and bleeding and dizzy. And then this guy came along in a little pickup, And he said in Spanish, like, hey, I saw what happened. Get in. You know, spent probably half an hour driving around these narrow streets until we found the hostel. So that was a real kind of illustration of the duality of human nature, you know, the robbers and the Good Samaritan right there. After, you know, surviving my brush with death there, got home and stepped off the airplane in Seattle and took a big deep breath of the fresh spring northwest air, and I remember that in particular. The air smelled so good. Got home to San Juan Island and made a little cold frame with some nice sandy soil and planted out the seeds. And yeah, that spring they started popping up, little spiny little green shoots growing up. But yeah, I feel like that trip was a pivotal moment in my life, going from one phase into the next. And on the plane ride back, I tried to remember everything that I had drawn in that sketchbook. You know, really it's the memories are what we have. And so I sat there on the plane and I felt like that was kind of a good experience in a way, to lose that sketchbook. You can still remember it and tell the story, and so that was a useful lesson.
Dan Tucker lives on San Juan Island. You can see some of his sketches and photos on our website, knkxsoundeffect.org. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme this week is The Collector. Before people were burying their souls on Facebook and Instagram, creative folks with something to say poured their efforts into making their own magazines. Today, some people are still crafting these unique publications, although their heyday was definitely pre-internet. They're called zines.
The way I describe zines are that they are small, handmade magazines that are made out of passion, and they're not made for profit. They are very idiosyncratic, individual publications that really reflect the passions and opinions of particular individuals.
Abby Bass is standing next to boxes full of zines. This is the Seattle Public Library's Zine Archive and Publishing Project, or ZAP. Abby worked with this collection once before as a volunteer when it was based at Richard Hugo House on Capitol Hill. Today, Abby's one of the librarians working to catalog the more than 30,000 zines from all over the country. And before we jump into this story, I just want to let you know that toward the end, one of the examples does contain some sexual content. So back to Abby. For her, working on this collection is personal.
I actually started making zines when I was 13 years old. I went to summer camp in North Carolina, and the art director at that camp was the editor for a local zine that he published. And in fact, I think those zines are in this collection. I think the easiest way to understand what a zine is to pick one up and look through it.
Let's do that.
Okay. Well, I've got some in the back here if you want to take a look at them. This collection began in 1996 it was started by a couple folks who made zines, Chuck Swaim, Gary Greaves, and Annie Fanning. And they were really interested in preserving what is a pretty ephemeral kind of publication. They're much harder to track down than an average periodical.
Yeah, these aren't typically something you're going to find in the magazine section of a chain bookstore or on however other ways people used to buy magazines, like those Publishers Clearinghouse things that come in the mail. These are all pretty much self-published?
Yes. A lot of them are just cut and paste, Xerox at the local Kinko's or copy shop, and just handed out to people. So we're actually hearing authentic voices. We're hearing from them directly about their lives and about how they see the world. In the 70s and 80s, there were a lot of punk fanzines and music fanzines that really documented the underground music scene. And in fact, this right here is Subterranean Pop, which is the zine that Bruce Pavitt did when he was an undergraduate at Evergreen College in Olympia.
And the obviously the name Sub Pop is
Did it come from this?
Yes, it does come from the scene. He was really trying to spread the word about what he thought was a very vibrant music scene that folks should know about. And then, so he kind of spells out his manifesto here. As our teen bongo space-age counterculture becomes infiltrated by wimpoid TV mop tops and skinny ties and leather pants, it becomes apparent that the bland sameness of the pop superstructure is with us once again. Once adventurous bands who now opt for major label contracts are immediately becoming the robot slaves of a system that is interested in one thing only, money.
What do you think that that conveys about the time and place of the writing and this format, the zine?
This is a medium for folks to give voice to whatever their opinions are. You know, it really allows this kind of not unfiltered, direct opinion about the state of the world. And in this case, he's describing what he thinks about the music industry. And I believe this is 1979, 1980, so a few decades ago.
There's something about a self-published thing where you don't have a gatekeeper that you need to please or whatever that allows him, in this case, to write with verve and some swagger.
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of zines in this collection that are written by people who are often marginalized in our society, women of color, queer folks, disabled folks. This one here, Ring of Fire, actually is a local author. I'm trying to sort of highlight some of the local zines we have here. E.T. Russian, who still lives in Seattle, and they are actually really active in disability activism and also in the local arts community. But this zine, they wrote when they were 19 years old, and it was after they experienced a terrible accident train hopping, and they had to have both their legs amputated. And they started writing about this experience and what it meant to be a disabled young queer person who was also questioning ideas about gender, questioning ideas about sexuality. And this I think came out in like 1996 or 97. And it still feels really timely and relevant and just really fresh. Yeah, 1997.
So what's this one look like?
So this one on the cover, it's pink. It's smaller. It's
like the size of a quarter sheet of paper.
Yeah, it's a quarter sheet size zine.
Would you read a little smidge from that
too?
Sure.
Let me see what I can find. All right. How about disabled slut? Having sex as a disabled person is different than it was before I was disabled. I have to maneuver myself around differently. Because both my legs were amputated, it makes it harder to be smooth in bed. I have to always prop myself up on my knees because I have no feet. I would wear my prostheses, fake legs, in bed, but they're not so comfortable, plus the ankles on them don't bend, so my feet are always sticking up funny at a 90-degree angle. In other words, I have to plan out every move I make, which takes some of the spontaneity of sex and makes me embarrassed sometimes too. Sometimes I get self-conscious. That's another reason why having sex as a crip can be different. I'm more vulnerable.
So, I mean, maybe that doesn't sound that radical to somebody today who's used to social media and used to a bazillion different, you know, blogs and publications online. But to somebody in 1997, when that stuff was just in its infancy, this seems like it would be pretty unusual.
Right. I think you have to remember that, like, in 1997, there wasn't a whole community of blogs or Facebook or any of those things that people could search out. I mean, it was a really different landscape. And so, they're just talking really honestly and candidly about what it means for them now to have sex. But I think trying to find that, I mean, going to the library to find something written like this, you wouldn't find it in the library at that time.
Yeah, that probably isn't not a Dewey Decimal subject.
Right.
Yeah. Last question. Have you, like, encountered your own zines as you've been going through the collection at any point? And if so, how did that feel?
I have. There was some cringing involved, but some of them were a little angst-ridden and,
Do you remember any specific subjects that you wrote about?
I wrote about body image, and I remember writing a rant about, like, teen magazines that I thought were promoting really unrealistic standards of beauty and size. So that was that is one thing I can recall directly from that zine. But I guess I'm also, I would say there's a certain sense of pride that I did create this thing. And at some point it's going to be cataloged and it will be findable in this collection. And someone might find it and read it and say, oh, this is cool.
That's Abby Bass, a librarian with the Seattle Public Library. To see photos and learn how to visit the zine collection, go to our website, knkxsoundeffect.org. Hey, I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This is Sound Effect, and today we're telling stories about collectors. This one starts back in the day before Washington State took over the ferry system. Out on Puget Sound, here's what you would have heard. That little melody was the sound of a ferry coming into dock, and it had a name.
Well, Warp and Two Woofs, it's long and two shorts, so it's earn, earn, earn.
In the middle of the last century, one man amassed a huge audio collection of these sounds. But this wasn't just an obscure hobby. He had a mission. Here's Sound Effect's Posey Gruner with the story.
Imagine it's 1950, and you're standing in downtown Seattle, watching the ferries come in from across the Sound. You would have heard the Warp and Two Woofs all the time. Historian Alan Stein says it must have sounded like music. Each ferry sounded a little different.
So some of them would be a little higher pitched, some would be a little lower pitched.
And each ferry captain had their own way of pulling the horn.
Some of them would make the shorts even shorter. Some of them would make the long even longer. Some of them would add a little tremble at the end.
It was a slow-motion symphony of honks and blasts, and it was also a language for those who could understand it. That included ferry captains, dock workers, and a guy named William Thornley.
He could stand there on the waterfront and say, oh, that's Captain so-and-so coming in on the Chesapeake, or, oh, yeah, that's this other captain, and that and the ferry boat that we're hearing is the Kalakala.
Thornley was not some kind of savant. He just knew a lot about ferries. Thornley had been the advertising manager for the big ferry company at the time. Well, actually, the only ferry company at the time, the Black Ball Line. His job was to promote the image of the ferries. And to an extent, says Alan Stein, he was also promoting the image of the Northwest itself.
I mean, before the Space Needle was here, the most popular attraction in Washington State was the ferry Kalakala for years. You know, so people would come out here on vacation and go back to Illinois and say, oh, wow, I saw this ferry boat. It looked like a Buck Rogers spaceship. It was amazing. It was called the Kalakala or something.
In fact, it was Thornley who named the ferry Kalakala.
And it's an old Chinook term for flying bird. But it had, you know, had that K sound. K sounds are always funny, you know. And so I think he was looking at it from that aspect of, you know, let's have a name that's really memorable that people go, wow, what is that name all about?
Thornley was an ad man, and it was the 50s, and he was working for a private company. Stein says that left room for a certain amount of pizzazz.
That was the hole that Bill Thornley filled, was promoting it in a way that was fun, that was kind of goofy, and, you know, it had these odd little things that you remembered.
Thornley was a real expert in the fun and the memorable, even if, in the case of his famous pranks, the fun was mostly his.
If he had to send blueprints to somebody, he had those big cardboard tubes that you would put him in, and he would fill them with ping pong balls. You know, just, you know, and I love that kind of prank, the kind of prank that you pull that you can't see. You know, it's just like you just know that somebody opened this up and went, whoa, ping pong balls over my office. Just, you know, what a fun guy.
Then, in 1951, things changed. The company Thornley worked for, the Black Ball Line, was taken over by the state. After they'd kept rates low for years during the Depression and then the war, the company finally hiked the rates way up, and that's when Washington State realized that a ferry monopoly could be a really bad thing.
What are you going to do, take the other ferry? There is no other ferry.
After years of dispute, Black Ball finally sold the entire system to Washington State. A few Black Ball employees who were close to retirement just retired, including Bill Thornley. But the state got nearly everything else. They got the ferries and the captains, the docks and the dock workers. And, says Alan Stein, they also got something less tangible. The idea of the Northwest.
It was a cultural landmark of the Northwest. This was something unique to us. It's something we can be proud of.
On June 1st, 1951, Washington State Ferries officially took over. The old flag, a black ball, had been lowered. A green stripe, the color of an evergreen tree, was painted across the ferries. But then, and this one is important, one of the woofs was missing.
A warp and a woof. He even mentioned at the time, he said, this just sounds wrong. It's just, there's something just uncomfortable about that.
Thornley did not approve of the change. The old black ball ferry captains didn't love it either.
Their whole life, they were used to pulling that whistle and doing it their own way. And now they're being told by the state, no, you have to do this warp and a woof. And that didn't sit well.
Some took to calling it the groan and the grunt. But still, the captains pulled the whistle. The ferries groaned and grunted, and the 50s carried on. Then, in 1957, a veteran captain named Louis Van Bogart announced his retirement. His fellow captains dared him to go out on his final docking with a warp and two woofs. And that's what he did. This gave Bill Thornley an idea. He realized he could bring back the warp and two woofs. He just had to sell the idea to the legislature. And he was an ad man. He could do that. That's when Thornley decided to collect each and every ferry signal in all of their varied glory.
That's just it. It wasn't just one ferry whistle. If he went down to the legislature and had one ferry whistle, well, here's what this one sounds like. You know, that's not interesting. But when you have one after the other, after the other, after the other, and you're showing the whole complete spectrum of all these ferry boats, that's got weight. That's got importance to it.
Thornley convinced them. And on May 24th, 1958, in celebration of Maritime Day, they reinstituted the warp and two woofs. Thornley died in 1980, but Washington State Ferry spokesperson Ian Sterling says that the warp and two woofs are still used on Washington State ferries, at the captain's discretion. He adds that no other ferry system he knows of makes this sound, which makes it something of a Northwest signature.
I'm sure Bill Thornley somewhere is very glad to know that.
That story from Sound Effects' Posey Gruner. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, this is Sound Effect, and our theme today is The Collector. Producer Kevin Kniestad has an accidental collection, or at least one he accumulated subconsciously. Over about 25 years, Kevin has been saving letters, all of which have one thing in common. And when he recently reread them, it brought up some tricky questions. He shares this essay.
Everyone who has had to make a long-distance move in their life, where they decided to take with them only what they could fit in their car, has been tasked with deciding what is absolutely necessary. clean underwear, maybe some dishes. But on my multiple cross-country moves, I made room in the mid-size sedan for a sentimental item or two. In my case, that included a small wooden box my grandfather had made when he was young. When he gifted it to me, it included some poker chips and a deck of cards. And at some point, I removed the chips and cards and felt like this would be a good place to store letters I received. And over the course of time, all the letters had one thing in common. They all came from people I dated. Receiving these letters from old girlfriends during a span of time where texting and emailing was already so much easier made it feel like it was sort of disrespectful to throw them away. And without giving it much thought, I'd stick them in my grandfather's box. And that's where they rested, largely untouched after their initial reading. As I would add letters to the box over the years, I wouldn't go back and read the old ones. There was this certain anxiety I had with that, like acknowledging that I held onto them would reflect an inability of mine to let go of the past. Tucking them away out of the light of day was okay. I wasn't clinging on to a lost love, but instead storing memories away the same way I would do in my head. And yet, during a recent bout of spring cleaning, there it was, my grandfather's box. Why today seemed like a good day to go through the letters, I can't quite say. Maybe it was the fact that my 40th birthday was approaching and I wanted to see if there were any common threads in these letters that might explain why I was still single. I was surprised to see how many letters had accumulated, and once I started reading them, I was also surprised at what I had forgotten about from my past.
Dear Kevin, I'm so glad that we got to know each other this summer. It was one of the best summers of my life, and I'm sad it had to end. I know we are both going to have a great freshman year of college at our respective schools. I painted you a painting of the Seattle skyline as a reminder of our time together this summer, and since you are leaving Seattle, a way for you to still feel close to home. I look forward to seeing what life has in store for us down the road.
I remember that painting, and I remember feeling bad about being talked into throwing this really nice artwork in the trash when another girlfriend came along, jealous that there were remnants of the past hanging up in my apartment. The next one, written on handmade paper, read,
Dear Kevin, one of the first things I grew a liking to while studying in Slovakia was the plum brandy. I'm not sure if this is a place you would actually enjoy. It doesn't really seem like you. But I've always been happy that we've been able to remain such good friends after our breakup, and I wanted you to know how life has been. And here's hoping life is treating you well.
That one I actually received when I was still in high school, and I ended up going to prom with her after she returned from Slovakia. She brought some of that plum brandy that evening to prom, and it did not go well. So all these letters were a nice reminder that I was always a model boyfriend and always a model ex-boyfriend. Everyone was always able to move on with ease, but of course, that's not how it works. And if each letter I went through marked a chapter, there were chapters that were less pleasant to revisit, like this next one.
Dear Kevin, I know you don't want to hear from me right now, but your roommate texted me and he's worried. He said you aren't eating much and that you haven't been to work. I've been torn between whether or not I should write you and if it would actually help or hurt. But if you never listen to anything I've ever said to you before, please listen now. You are important, with or without me, and you need to take care of yourself.
I actually remember that this did help, and I remember being very motivated by it, at least for a little while. I lost a bunch of weight, in a healthy way, made new friends, and had a really great time. But as time went on and the letter collected dust in my grandfather's box, the motivation faded as well. It was around then that I received a slightly less gentle letter. This next one arrived in my early 30s.
Kevin, I've told you this before that you're probably the smartest person I've ever met, but I'd rather be with someone half as smart as you that's doing something than to be with a waste of a genius.
For the record, I am no genius. In fact, a friend told me once that, while he cared about me very much, he would never hire me to be his doctor or lawyer. I've often thought that if I was that smart, I would have been able to figure out relationships a long time ago. As I got to the bottom of my grandfather's box, there was the last letter. It was not the oldest under any circumstances, which makes me think that I intentionally buried it.
Dear Kevin, I love you so much, and it is hard to believe how quickly and deeply we fell in love. Every moment I spend with you is so special. I remember our first kiss in the car, and the first moment I knew I loved you. But I know that if there is a chance that I can make it work, I owe it to my marriage to try and make it work. I don't know what the future holds, and I don't know if I'll ever see you or talk to you again, which breaks my heart. But this is what I need to do.
That one hurt. And spare me the judgment. There isn't a day that's gone by where I haven't punished myself for that. If there was a letter that did not need to be written, it was that one. The kiss in the car, knowing that I severely impacted more than just my own relationship, and saying goodbye for the benefit of two people, neither of whom are me, needed no written reminder. After I reread that last one, I cried. And I started to wonder what I'd been thinking, keeping all of these letters over the course of 25 years. What exactly did I have in mind back then, saving these painful reminders? I thought about that a lot after I put my grandfather's box away, and what I sort of landed on was that if I knew at some point down the road I would end up rereading these, then the odds were good that by the time I did, I had overcome whatever sort of heartbreak and pain I had felt at the time I received them. Instead of these being a painful reminder, they could be a reminder of how far I'd come. And it hit me that maybe the one person who really needed to write me a letter was me. That while the words from Love's Lost were in fact reminders of things I had overcome, maybe I needed to give myself a little reminder too. So I sat down, I wrote a few drafts, but I just couldn't seem to get across to myself exactly what I wanted to remind myself of. And would I just end up putting this letter in my grandfather's box, only to forget about it and find it years down the road collecting dust on another day of spring cleaning? So I landed on a different kind of letter to myself, a letter I could see every day. I had my best friend take me to a tattoo parlor, something that on any other day of my life up until now would have terrified me. And on my left shoulder, I had tattooed, "You got this." Nothing fancy, in Times New Roman, the font I like to read my copy in on the radio, but a daily reminder that whatever letter may arrive next, I got this. I've decided to keep those old letters, at least for now. While the tattoo was for me, keeping these letters is now for them. I may never see any of my exes again, but it's my way of saying to them that no matter what trials and heartbreak they may have had to deal with over the years, no matter what letters they may have received in the mail, they've got this too.
That essay from Sound Effects' Kevin Canista. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestead, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner, with help this week from Max Wasserman and Aaron Hennessy. Our executive producer is Matt Martinez. Special thanks to Chloe Watson, Stephanie Erickson, McKenna Hunt, Simone Alisea, and Kari Plogue. You can find our free podcast on Spotify, NPR One, or wherever else you get your podcasts. We're hugely grateful when folks leave a rating and review us on Apple Podcasts. And you can send feedback to soundeffect@knkx.org. Meet you back here next week when our theme is Connections. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.